Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a health and environmental journalist. I write for the Huffington Post and host an e-zine that you can find on my website, where my blogs are also posted, healthjournalistblog.com. Every week, I bring to listeners here on the Progressive Radio Network different aspects of science, of spiritual wisdom, of environmental knowledge, of social policy analysis, and of calls to action to help protect health in our environment, because there's a kind of myth that if we just work on ourselves, we got it covered. But in fact, we live not only as part of spiritual oneness, but as part of a whole living biosphere. And a lot of the things that go on there and that we allow there and that influence our food, our water, our personal products, our air and our society impact our health. And so that's what we talk about every week on Connect the Dots. This week we have a really terrific show, and I usually, as regular listeners know, begin the show with an action item, because it's about being informed, and it's also about being a citizen and taking action. And this week's action is really relevant to today's show, where we'll be discussing the health impacts of industrial toxins and personal products and in the environment, and how they function, and what a new study shows with a leading scientist on this front doing research. But we also have some very direct health impacts coming down line to those of us in the New York and Northeast region. And today's action speaks to that. As many people know, I've done a lot of programs on Connect the Dots on the issue of hydraulic fracturing, on fracking, and also mentioned many actions. We've had leaders of grassroots advocacy organizations on the show. And I've reported on Huffington on the guidelines put forth by the state of New York as a prelude to bringing fracking into New York State, which has many possible impacts. But one thing that was notably absent from the guidelines was, in fact, a health assessment. And so now people are calling for a health assessment, and because there isn't one in the plan. So even though there have been health impacts for reasons that we'll learn more about on today's show, you know, when fracking has been done in other states, particularly in our neighbor state of Pennsylvania, these are not well studied or well understood. And so right now, a group of 250 medical professionals are calling on the state to undertake a health assessment prior to fracking. And you can join your voices to theirs, because there are people in the New York State Assembly, led by Assemblyman Sheldon Silver, who'd like to see that happen. But they need to hear from us that we want it too. So I'm going to give you two numbers and a website to follow through on that action. You can call Assemblyman Silver's office in either New York City at 212-312-1420 or in his Albany office at 518-455-3791. And if you'd like to learn more about this, please check out a website. It's CatskillMountainKeeper.org. That's Catskill, C-A-T-S-K-I-L-L, MountainKeeper.org. Check it out. They'll tell you more about it. And you can also follow my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, and I'll provide further information there. Or you can sign up at my e-zine on my website, healthjournalistblog.com. And now let's move on to today's show. I'm very excited because we have something that really is to be celebrated in our world, because, you know, as we see in this action item, the government implements activities and allows products and processes without really doing the necessary scientific research, while, you know, we assume it's kind of okay. And now, bit by bit and stroke by stroke, more research is being done, and we have today's guest and our organization to thank for some exciting new research, which we'll be discussing on today's program, that really sheds more light on these topics. So I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots, Robin Dodson. Saidi. She's a research scientist, and her special expertise is in assessing exposure to indoor air pollution and working with asthma and a whole bunch of other things. She has a doctorate in environmental health that she received from the Harvard School of Public Health, and she works with an organization that we'll talk more about in the program, the Silent Spring Institute, which is basically based on the work of Rachel Carson, the first environmentalist in America. So I'm so delighted to have you with us today. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Robin.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be with you.
So let's just begin by talking a little bit about the work of, for readers who may not know, or listeners, rather, who may not know, who is Rachel Carson and what is Silent Spring and the Silent Spring Institute, just to kind of bring people up to speed.
Sure. So Rachel Carson, as you had just mentioned, right, is one of our first environmentalists. She was looking at exposures to pesticides in the environment and their effect on different species, including birds, and it was kind of the first connection that people started to make between the chemicals in our environment and the effects on health. And so she wrote a book called Silent Spring, in which she talked about her work in this area and what she was observing in the world around her. A lot of people don't realize, but as she, just after she wrote the book and as she was testifying before Congress about her findings, she was actually suffering from breast cancer. She was, unfortunately, she ultimately died of breast cancer and kind of did this in a kind of a private way. But we didn't, it's kind of a testament to her as one of the first environmentalists as well as a breast cancer survivor. We were founded in her honor. We were founded specifically, the Silent Spring Institute, because we had observed some higher rates of breast cancer, particularly on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Massachusetts typically is one of the top 5 or 10, say, states that in terms of breast cancer incidence. And back in about 1993, the cancer registry came out showing that the Cape actually had cancer rates that were 21% above state average. So not only do we had a state that, is typically one of the highest in terms of incidence, now we have a particular region of the state that has very high breast cancer rates.
Mm-hmm.
Our research, research had shown that these high rates of cancer on Cape Cod breast cancer could not be attributed to known breast cancer risk factors. So a local group here called the Massachusetts Breast Cancer Coalition decided that they wanted to start what they called a lab of their own. They wanted to bring scientists together to try to answer some questions about what could be causing these high rates of breast cancer. And one of the particular questions they wanted to look at was the role of the environment in breast cancer. This is kind of trying to fill a gap out there that there really wasn't a research institution, and even the federal government wasn't really paying attention to the idea that environmental chemicals may influence cancers such as breast cancer. So they decided to create this organization to try to answer those scientific questions. We were first funded by the state to try to look at the cancer incidence on the Cape and what might be explaining that. But really our work has kind of since then has kind of blossomed to more of a national effort to try to understand more broadly how chemicals in the environment might be affecting our health.
Yeah, and previous guests on this program have included Andy Egregious, who is campaign director of Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, which is an initiative to change public policy and improve government study and Environmental Protection Agency study of these chemicals, because shockingly, they aren't studied. There are 80,000 in existence, of which mere handful, several thousand, have either been grandfathered or looked at in any way, shape, or form. So while people assume that the government is kind of looking out for us, and that science must have, kind of given their imprimatur, in fact, that's not the case at all. After the fact, after exposure, with rising cancer rates and spectrum disorders and a whole, respiratory conditions and a whole bunch of other things, we're now beginning, finally, to look into what some of these things are and what their impact on us is. And it's quite, and it runs the gamut, really, doesn't it, from, personal products that you can elect to use to industrial products to which you may be exposed without your choice or any consumer power to do anything. But a lot of the consciousness raising around this problem has occurred through product studies. In other words, we're actually choosing to use products, or other people are using products that wind up impacting us. And so the first look has been at everyday consumer items like shampoos and sunscreens and laundry detergents and other things like that. And that's what's so exciting about this new study of which you're lead author, that is, you know, really amazing. And it just came out, it's hot off the press, listeners, you know, just this past week in a research and scholarly journal called Environmental Health Perspectives. So tell us a little bit about the study, Robin.
Sure. So this study, which is called The Endocrine Disruptors and Asthma-Associated Chemicals in Consumer Products, this is the first kind of large assessment in the peer-reviewed literature of such a wide range of chemicals in a broad suite of products. So we specifically focused on endocrine disruptors or hormone disruptors and asthma-associated chemicals. And we looked for 66 different chemicals in 50 different product types. And those product types included things like personal care products, so lotions and toothpaste and makeup, cleaning products such as laundry detergents or surface cleaners, and other household items such as, say, a pillow protector or a shower curtain or cat litter. And we looked for these compounds in a broad range of these products. And the real reason, as you kind of mentioned, was, yes, we're finding these chemicals in our homes. Our previous research has focused mostly on household exposure, so, you know, what can we detect or what are we finding in our air and our dust in our homes? And then the Centers for Disease Control, CDC's biomonitoring program, has found these types of chemicals in our bodies. So this is trying to answer one of the questions of where is this coming from? In the environmental health world, we kind of always assumed they're probably coming from consumer products. But this was really the first time in the peer-reviewed literature that we actually tried to go look for these chemicals in these types of products. So it's kind of the first snapshot, if you will, of these types of products.
Yeah, that's really major. That's a really major undertaking to do all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the science and what you looked at and what it found, but I just wanted to interject a little story here so that, you know, and I think listeners can relate to it. I'm doing a book on some of these topics to sort of do what I do here on the show all the time and bring in some of the great wisdom that, you know, for many of the people that I've interviewed and, you know, research that I've looked at over the years to the general audience about these connections between our choices as a society, as citizens and as consumers, and, you know, and the impacts on our health. And the forces in our society that are kind of bringing us a lot of these things without really protecting our health and the need to raise awareness and really be active as citizens about this. But, you know, it all comes from personal stuff that happens to each one of us. And I have a friend who is sensitive to perfume odors, and there's kind of mixed fragrances that under sort of a catch-all name that can be used in anything from a body cream to a laundry soap to dryer sheets, for example, that, you know, people might use to, I don't know really why, to reduce, you know, one of the things that's happened is that all these different products have been marketed to us and we now believe we need them. And so, you know, dryer sheets for those that use them, for example, are said to reduce static cling, which actually, to be perfectly honest, isn't something that I've ever really noticed in drying clothes, and I don't use them. But apparently some people experience more of that, regard it as a problem, use these products, and they too contain fragrance. So a friend of mine was in a course, you know, that was going on where people were in close quarters and doing exercises together and various things, and somebody in the room was wearing clothing that wafted these odors into the room, and there, you know, I might not choose to purchase them, but I might inhale them because somebody nearby to me when I'm in yoga class or whatever and everyone is sweating may have them on their clothes, and that would even constitute a secondary exposure. And yet, you know, and some people may smell it and feel a reaction. Others may not notice it. But, you know, in fact, even my neighbor in yoga class is a choice about a product purchase, you know, could also impact me. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about, like, what's fragrance. I mean, what can you tell us about, you know, this catch-all of fragrance? You know, it's our senses tell us it smells good. What's in it? Is it really good? How well has it been studied?
That's a great question. So fragrances is kind of this kind of catch-all term. And if you look at the International Fragrance Association's website, they list the types of chemicals that might be considered fragrances. And you notice that there's over 1,000 different chemicals that could be kind of classified as fragrance. And what's kind of interesting, or unfortunately rather worrisome, is that when fragrances are used in products, if you look at the product label, all you see is the word fragrance. You don't see these individual chemicals that would constitute this fragrance. So it's kind of a catch-all, and it's been shown that, you know, this mixture, which is oftentimes the product manufacturers call a proprietary mixture, so it's protected under trade secrets, can contain, say, 10, 20, 30, 50 different types of chemicals making up this mix. And we don't necessarily know what that mix is, and the product label certainly doesn't help out. So we looked at a variety of different types of fragrances to try to understand what are the types of fragrances that are being used. Now, as I mentioned, there's such a broad range of chemicals that may be, in a fragrance mix. Some, they're not all created equal, but we do know that some of the synthetic fragrances that are used in these types of fragrance mixes can have endocrine disrupting effects. And then there's also this idea, right, where some fragrances, some particular people are particularly sensitized to fragrances, and it may, say, exacerbate or worsen asthma symptoms or other respiratory symptoms. So we know that. But really, you know, this area in particular, in terms of these types of chemicals, is really ongoing, and we're still learning more about what these types of chemicals are, what are we typically exposed to, and what that might mean for health.
Can you just kind of give an indication of the activity of a chemical like the fragrance ingredients that you mentioned? And again, because of proprietary secrets, there's no way for anyone to know which ones might, unless you're buying a natural product where it's detailed and it doesn't say fragrance as a general term, which ones might be in a given product that one uses. But can you explain what is the, you know, I think one of the difficulties I think we have communicating about this to the public is that when, you know, obviously I'm familiar with it as a journalist, but when we use a term like endocrine disruption, and there have been, studies done by Dr. Theo Colburn, a co-author of Our Stolen Future, which show that the chemicals used in fracking with the water to get the gas up and everything are also endocrine disruptors that can, you know, travel through water and impact people's health. But, you know, for a general listener and general member of the public, I hear the term endocrine disruptors. It sounds very complicated. So let's break that down, if you wouldn't mind, Robin, for people. I know we've done it in the past a bit on the show, but you're really, you know, we're really at the source here and talking to you about it. What's the problem? How does this act? What can it do? What does it do to our health? Can you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. So these endocrine disrupting compounds, sometimes you hear them as EDCs or hormone disruptors, mm-hmm. They're chemicals that can mimic or otherwise alter our body's hormone system. So our body has several different hormone systems, right? We have the estrogen system, which is kind of the female hormone system, the male hormone system, which is the androgen system. We have the thyroid system. And these hormone systems are working throughout our body to, you know, upregulate different processes and certain things in our environment, well, in our body, rather. But evidence from laboratory and human studies have suggested that these EDCs, or these hormone disruptors, can affect the development of reproductive and nervous systems, metabolism, and even cancer. And that's actually how we came about studying these types of chemicals, was because we were trying to understand what types of chemicals might influence breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And it has been shown in laboratory studies that chemicals that act like estrogen, so they can mimic estrogen, can affect how breast cancer cells grow in a lab. Mm. And so that's kind of a very, one particular example of how these endocrine disruptors can affect us. But really, because of the, we have these hormone systems working throughout our body, the potential health effects are quite broad. So we typically think about it in terms of cancer. Some of these compounds that we looked at might be associated with what is called anti-androgen effects, which is basically it blocks testosterone in the body. So some of these phthalates are considered to be anti-androgen. So, and how we've seen this is in laboratory studies and in some human studies, we've seen this effect, the effect of phthalate exposure on reproductive development, particularly in boys. Especially when they're exposed in utero or when they're exposed as very young children, it can affect how the reproductive systems are developing. So really I would say that this, it's obvious we understand that this is a possibility of these types of chemicals affecting our hormone systems, but I would say we're just at the beginning of really understanding the total impact of these types of chemicals.
So we're being exposed to them, but they're basically, there's decades, I don't know, one decade, two decades, depending on, how quickly the research can be funded, mm-hmm. Of research ahead of us that needs to be done by scientists like you to really know, even as we day by day are constantly being affected by these, to know what we're really, what the effects are. I mean, that's pretty disturbing, I guess, isn't it?
Right, and I think it kind of points to how we think about and regulate some of our chemicals out there, is that mm-hmm. unfortunately we regulate it kind of looking in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's kind of an example of this, is that these chemicals have been out there. We know we're exposed to them, but the kind of the understanding of what they might do to health is still kind of unfolding.
Mm-hmm. I was just, I have two of the books that I have written have been, because I've written a number of books and I'm writing a new one now, but I have been New York Times bestsellers, and two have been nominees for a prestigious award in the wellness and self-help book industry called Books for a Better Life. And ever since the first was nominated a decade ago, I have been a judge for that award, which is given in all different categories, from wellness to green to psychology to money management, to motivational books, spiritual books. Every year this award looks at all these categories and awards in all these different categories to the books that this group, votes. It's like the Oscar mm-hmm. for self-help books. And I've been a category judge ever since my first book was nominated 10 years ago. And so actually just this past week we had the award ceremony, and the award every year is to benefit the New York chapter of the National MS Society. And the award event actually raises money, and the publishing industry is both honored and also contributes financially to raising money for MS treatment. And it's a really noble thing. I was speaking to the sort of genius behind this, the organizer, at the event, which was just the last couple of days that I attended, and said to him, wouldn't it be great to look both into treatment and into causes? Because, my ears pricked up a bit, Robin, when you mentioned that this also, these endocrine disruptors also interact with neurological functioning of the nervous system in our body. And it's obviously, I wouldn't put you on the spot by saying, could they be causing MS, although that's kind of the hidden question here. Mm-hmm. But the answer would be, we don't know. They could be. Maybe we should look into it. I know that's not your specific area of expertise, but it's just that without studying, we're kind of in an unknown realm. And so, here we are, for example, through this organization and this event that I have, volunteered for, trying to, treat something, but meanwhile, we still may be causing something that we're then spending millions of dollars trying to understand and treat. I mean, is it what it, you know, how to, for example, so, and also when people hear hormones, you know, men, for example, may think, oh, hormones, women. Mm-hmm. You just explained how it affects male development as well, but how does it affect the nerve, how do they affect the nervous system? Do we know much about that? I mean, what do we know at this point?
I would say, actually, it's an area where we're still trying to learn more. I mean, we know some of these reproductive systems may be affected because it kind of makes sense, right? If we're affecting, say, estrogen or testosterone, it kind of makes sense that they may affect the reproductive system. The effects on the nervous system is very new, and we're still trying to learn more. So I think, I think this kind of gets back to the how difficult it is to try to do these types of studies and try to understand more. And understand what's going on. You know, unlike clinical trials where we can expose a group of people to a chemical and kind of wait and see what happens, it's a lot more complicated here when we're talking about chemicals in the environment, not only because people are exposed to a wide range of chemicals, so trying to understand which particular chemical may be causing which particular health effect is quite difficult. But it's rather unethical, right, to sit down and start exposing people just to see what their effects might be. So we are kind of stuck with trying to use different types of lines of evidence to try to understand these types of interactions between chemicals and disease, and it can be quite difficult to find a controlled or unique experiment, if you will, to really see what the effects might be. So in this case, I can't necessarily talk to whether or not, you know, there might be a relationship with MS, although it's kind of an interesting question to look into.
Mm-hmm. Well, that also brings up another point, and maybe, we'll discuss it briefly now, but we have to, get into our break pretty soon. Mm-hmm. Another minute or two, but, you know, maybe it's something we'll talk about after the break, but this also gets into the nature of science itself, which is that, as you say, the way science works, and I don't know the way around this, but, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem to be one, but the way it works is that, you know, there's a chain of evidence between, you know, one instigating cause and, you know, one effect or several possible effects. But in order to identify that and lock it down, it has to be studied one by one. And yet, you know, the exposures are not happening one by one. And so as science sort of plods along and tries to study this piece one by one and this piece one by one, meanwhile, we're being exposed to one by one by one by one by two by 2,000 by 80,000, you know. So, and I was interested to hear you say it wouldn't be ethical to expose participants in a study to a potential toxin in order to study its impact upon them. And yet we are, in fact, making a decision as a society and as consumers who purchase products to expose ourselves and each other to a whole host of different things. So I'm going to ask you, how ethical is that? I'd like to hear your thoughts, and then we'll take a break and come back for the second half of the show.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think part of that is, I think, raising just awareness. I think mm-hmm. part of it is that people don't necessarily know what they're being exposed to and what they might be exposing others to. There tends to be a lack of transparency out there. We've seen this in this study in particular, right, is that we looked at these types of chemicals to see what they might, you know, what types of chemicals might be in different products. But part another analysis that we did kind of along with this was to try to understand if you could select products based on the label themselves, and if you could select products with little or no chemicals of concern. And the result is, unfortunately, no, we can't necessarily mm-hmm. all the time. So mm-hmm. it's a question out there is that I think a lot of people think if they go, say, into your local chain drugstore and pick, a shampoo off the shelf, they think that that product has been thoroughly tested, that anything in it might be is perfectly safe for our health. They don't quite realize that there's, unfortunately, kind of a gap in the regulations out there where we don't know what those chemicals in that product might do to us, and actually we don't even know what is in that product necessarily. So I think there's a lack of transparency, unfortunately, so people don't understand really what they're being exposed to.
That's really very powerful statement, you know, to take in and really contemplate for everyone, for all of us. And, you know, very well put, Robin. That's really important. We're going to take a break now for station identification on Progressive Radio. Please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of my conversation with Robin Dotson about these really important issues and more about the new study and what that shows. Stay with us here and connect the dots for the second half of the hour. Welcome, listeners, back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, we're talking about the science and policy of industrial chemicals and how they affect our health with research scientist Robin Dotson of the Silent Spring Institute, which based upon and in honor of the work of Rachel Carson, the first environmentalist, is conducting research and beginning to fill in the many blanks around our understanding of the health impacts of chemicals and ingredients used in a wide range of consumer and industrial products without proper study. And as we ended our last half hour of the show, Robin was just saying that, you know, it really gives pause. Most people don't realize, you said, Robin, that, you know, they go to the Rite Aid and get a shampoo and they assume someone has vetted the ingredients. But that isn't often the case. And many of the ingredients are unknown, many are untested, many are hidden as trade secrets that protect the corporate right but don't protect the health rights of the consumer. And so we don't know what is in a lot of these products. And, you know, it's a shortfall in science, and it's a shortfall in industry, and it's a shortfall in government policy. And it's also a shortfall in our understanding that this is going on, and that's what we talk about a lot in Connect the Dots, and it's really great to have you here with us, giving your perspective as a scientist, Robin. So thank you so much. It's really great having you here. So let's turn around and talk a little bit more specifically about the recent study that you, of which you were a lead author in Environmental Health Perspectives, where you looked at a whole range of ingredients and common consumer products, and tell us more about what you found.
Right. So as I mentioned before, this is the first large peer-reviewed assessment of hormone disruptors and asthma-associated chemicals in consumer products. And these are products that we're exposed to every day. We looked for 66 different chemicals, and we actually detected 55 of them, suggesting that we're exposed to a wide range of chemicals in these products that, from these products that we're using every day. This research also shows that we're exposed to a variety of mixtures. So the idea here is that, you know, we had talked in the previous half hour about thinking about one chemical at a time, but this research really shows is that, in fact, we are not exposed to one chemical at a time. We're exposed to a whole mixture of chemicals, not only a mixture, say, in one particular type of product, so say in your shampoo, but we're also exposed to a mixture in the idea that we use shampoo and conditioner and face wash and, you know, tub and tile cleaner and laundry detergent in a given day. So we kind of make this soup of this chemical soup around us, and this is really showing, you know, what the broad range of types of exposures that we might be receiving because of these products that we're using in our house.
Yeah, well, oh, that's great. And how are you able to do that? That's really a huge breakthrough.
Yeah,
in looking at the combination of effects. I mean, and how were you able to do that, and what did you find?
Right, so we looked at a variety of different product types, so the personal care products, the cleaning products, and the household products. And what we did is we were trying to understand what might be in these products. So what we did is our first step was to contact manufacturers of these products and say, hey, can you tell us what's in these different products that we might be using? And you could imagine we actually didn't get very far in that research. So what we decided to do was say, okay, well, truly the only really way that we're going to understand what chemicals might be in these products is if we send them to a lab ourselves. So what we did is we defined products in two different ways. We defined them as both alternative and conventional. And alternative products, according to our definition, are products that meet a certain criteria. And that criteria, we set up this criteria before we even started shopping and sending these to the lab. But we determined alternative products to be those that were primarily plant-based and that the labels indicated either limited or no chemicals of concern, or say the labels explicitly said a chemical was not in it. So it might say fragrance-free in it.
Mm-hmm.
All other products were deemed as conventional. So we send these two different types, or two different broad categories of products, to the lab for analysis. And really what, you know, those conventional, so the alternatives were meant to look at one individual type of product at a time. So could we find this, you know, here we have a researcher going to the store, picking up the product and saying, hey, according to the label, I think this will have limited hormone disruptors or asthma-associated chemicals. Is this true? And we sent that off to the lab. Those conventional products are meant to represent typical products, everyday products. And because we were really just interested in what might be typical potential exposures, we actually combined multiple products, so say multiple shampoos, into one sample and tested that sample. So here we have individual alternative products and these composite or these combined conventional products. And we in fact did find that in every single one of those conventional samples, we detected at least one of our chemicals of concern. But we were able to identify 11 of our alternative products that contained none of the chemicals of concern. So that was a good thing, although unfortunately that means that there were many products, 32 of them, alternative products, where unfortunately there were chemicals of concern in them, even though we used a research-based criteria to select those products.
Mm. So that's pretty telling too. So, you know, basically then a takeaway briefly for our listeners would be that you know, if you go and buy the conventional brands that show up in the average supermarket, drugstore, you know, mass drugstores or whatever, the chances that you are exposing yourself to chemicals of concern, and we'll discuss a little bit more what is meant by that, mm-hmm. is high. On the other hand, if listeners to this show would probably be a higher proportion in a group, maybe, although it really, I mean, I've seen it, people who are sort of health savvy buying all kinds of things, supposedly, you know, without realizing it and all of that. But people that, you know, would be listening to Progressive Radio Network and following Gary Nall and listening to this program would be the ones that would be more inclined perhaps to be using the natural health products, so-called. And then actually, you know, there's problems there. So, you know, first step, so let's talk about those in two different chunks. So first step, so if I'm a kind of person that would go to Rite Aid and buy the shampoo and the conditioner and, you know, and the oven cleaner and some of the other products that you mentioned, is what, you know, the fact that the chemical of concern is present in a product or in several of the products and I'm being exposed to it routinely, what harm is there in that? Because there's a kind of assumption I think that people have. If, oh, it's only such a tiny amount and I only use it twice a week and, you know, it couldn't really have that much of an effect on me, are they mistaken about that? I mean, you know, how concerned those people who are using products regularly that contain the chemicals of concern, how worried should they be?
Well, I guess first of all, I should say that this study was looking at what is in these products. That was the real question.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that just it's important, especially for people who are, say, suffering from asthma, to stay away from chemicals that might be associated with asthma. Also, as for hormone disruptors, we know that people want to know what they're exposed to. Our research has shown that people typically, when we go into people's homes and do these types of, you know, monitoring studies in their homes, they typically say, what am I exposed to and how did it get here? So we know that people want to know where it's coming from. And laboratory studies have shown that these chemicals may be harmful even at these low levels that we might be seeing in these different products. But another thing about our study was that it calls for additional research, especially research on mixtures of these chemicals, because remember, you're not exposed to one chemical at a time, one product at a time. And then specifically, we highlight some of the combinations of chemicals or the actual mixtures that researchers should look into further. And we did that, we found that DEP, which is a phthalate, typically tends to co-occur with many of these fragrance compounds. So it might make sense, instead of thinking about, say, DEP in one study and then fragrances in another, we should think about maybe the combination of these and try to understand the health effects of those.
That's very interesting, because there is an assumption, you know, that the effect is maybe merely additive. In other words, if I, if I put a teaspoon of this with a teaspoon of that, then I get, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. Mm-hmm. But in fact, these are chemicals, and therefore they dance together, you know, and we know that we could put chemicals together, you know, as in your early lab experiment biology class, and we could cause bubbling or something might explode or different mm-hmm. things might happen. So some of these chemicals, when they interact, the effect may go a step beyond just simply 1 + 1 = 2. Can you explain a little bit about, like, what you found in that regard?
Sure. Well, I think you can think about it in different ways, but one way to think about it is in terms of these endocrine disruptors. Mm-hmm. Is that we have these chemicals that we know from studies that they may, say, affect a certain our health in a certain way. Several of these phthalates are considered to be androgenic, which means that they affect the testosterone system. The thing is that if you are exposed to, say, one phthalate, you could understand what the exposure might be. But studies have actually shown is that when you're exposed to multiple phthalates that occur or that affect the same health endpoint, or that end up in the same health endpoint in our bodies, in fact, you can't just, right, go 1 + 1 = 2, that effect or that combination leads to an effect that you can't necessarily predict on a 1 + 1 = 2 kind of math.
Mm-hmm.
So we know, thinking about this from a health endpoint, here we have multiple chemicals that might, act either along the same mechanism in our bodies or ultimately in the same the end point, right, that they might be contributing and leading to an even greater effect than we would have imagined.
Right. Now, that's if we had our highlighter pens, listeners, we'd be, highlighting that sentence. If this were, instead of live radio, that's going, that's a very important understanding there. Mm-hmm. So we are really, we're in a realm of unknown but potentially cumulative harm, through that very, that factor that you're mentioning there. So that's super, super important. Now let's just switch gears, because we were talking about the conventional products and what people that might use them routinely, should look out for or, kind of think about. Now let's switch gears and talk about the products we find in the natural store, where health food store, and we thought they were healthy and everything was great, and you found a certain percentage of them were fine and really free and of chemicals of what you're calling chemicals of concern, which have these serious health effects. But, then there are the ones that do contain some of them. Now, is there any way through looking at a label that people would know this? Is there a way that they could say, oh, I can tell that this product will be okay and this product I would be concerned about? Are there some basic ways they could use?
Sure.
And or in some cases, is there no way you would know? I mean, what is the spectrum on that?
Right. So I think there's two things there, right, is that, we did use a criteria when we were shopping for these these products. And unfortunately, this approach has shown that the labels tend to be incomplete, but it depends on the type of chemical. So there are certain chemicals of which, yes, reading labels can help. And then unfortunately, there are other chemicals that it doesn't quite work.
Okay, tell us what those are.
Sure. So, and this actually, I should say, we've developed a kind of a top, it's 12 tips, top 12 tips for that you can use when you're going out and trying to select products, and especially if you're concerned about these types of exposures. So the types of tips that we, the positive tips are just simply to use fewer products. Again, this idea that these things are acting cumulatively, they add up, right, is if we just use fewer products, we would be exposed potentially to less, to a smaller number of chemicals. To choose plant-based ingredients, you know, and typically this is a marketing edge for some products, so, you know, flip it over, see if things are primarily plant-based. We suggest using simple cleaners such as just plain water and baking soda or vinegar or very simple soap like Castile soap to do many of your cleaning tasks. And we also suggest, if you know, when feasible, to choose shade and hats and kind of cover-ups essentially for sun protection, to not always default to the use of sunscreen. So those are kind of the what you can do. Now, there are particular things on a product label that you can look for to try to avoid, and we found that our research has shown that this can be partially helpful. The first is fragrances, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flip that product over and see if it includes fragrance.
So if it says, what would be the phrases that we would want to look for?
So you could, if you flip it over and you're looking in the ingredients section, you might see it will actually say things like fragrance or perfume or something like that. But in particular, if they are advertising that it does not have a scent necessarily, you're looking for things that say fragrance-free. Research has shown, and this doesn't come necessarily out of our study, but some other research has shown that it's fragrance-free rather than, say, unscented is what you should be looking for. Because unscented might be that they're, and this seems really confusing, but that unscented products can be using scents to mask other scents to essentially come up with no scents, if that makes sense. So the idea here is that they could be using fragrances to try to hide other particular smells of their products. So if we're looking for fragrance-free products, or, you know, looking at the label itself and making sure that there is no fragrance in it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that since we found that vinyl products in particular had very high levels relative to these other types of levels that we see, but we found that vinyl products had concentrations of DEHP, which is diethylhexylphthalate, which is an endocrine disruptor. And it's a fairly well-studied endocrine disruptor for its effects on reproduction and male fertility. Those products, those vinyl products that we looked at, say the shower curtain, we found DEHP, the phthalate, at 28% by weight. That means a quarter of that shower curtain is this phthalate.
It's
quite striking. So avoiding vinyl products can obviously have an impact on what your exposure might be to this phthalate, which we are seeing more and more in the literature has effect on reproduction and other potential health effects. So choose vinyl free. Another thing is to choosing things to not always actually to say to choose products that are not antimicrobial or antibacterial. So there's kind of a general overuse of these types of products out there. I mean, there's other people have kind of been looking at what this might mean for health, but we know there's two different chemicals in there. There's triclosan and triclocarban. Those are two chemicals that are typically used to make, say, hand soap, antibacterial hand soap. And the triclosan has been shown to have effects on our thyroid system as well as some other effects, health effects. And so choosing to avoid antibacterial products is one way you can reduce your exposure. And CDC and FDA have actually have statements out there saying that simple, regular old soap and water is just as effective for cleaning as antibacterial soap and water. So we don't need to always default to that antibacterial stuff. And then there's two other types of things that you might typically see on a label. Those include parabens. Those are things that are typically used as preservatives in a product. Those are, I should say, we only found them in our personal care products, so not in cleaning products. So what you want to do for that is flip that product over. See, first of all, it might say paraben-free, or what you're looking for is products that do not contain words such as like methylparaben, ethylparaben, butylparaben, to try to avoid those. And another type of chemical that we found we could mostly avoid by reading the label were these compounds that are cycloxyloxanes, called cycloxyloxanes. These are things that typically make products smooth. And on the back of the label, you would see something like cyclomethicone. Or you may see cyclosiloxane, but I we did not see that necessarily. We saw cyclomethicone.
Is that like silica-containing product, silicone-containing
product? It is a silicon-based product,
uh-huh.
or a base chemical. But it's like it's the cyclical silicone. That's been getting more attention in terms of its potential health effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've been giving several tips here, but if you want to know more, and especially we have a little wallet card that you can download so you can stick it in your pocket for the next time that you go to the store, you can visit our website at silentspring.org, and we highlight these tips for your shopping.
That sounds terrific. So, yeah, listeners, definitely check out the website, silentspring.org. It's great for both information and also, you know, in our new media environment, you know, you don't hear a lot of this kind of information offered. It's not reported that widely, you know, in mainstream media. As we know, the government is not really paying for the kinds of studies we need or curbing the manufacturing products, you know, practices that are creating these products. So it's also important to get the information, but also to contribute, if you are able, to organizations like Silent Spring so that there's a cycle of giving and return, you know. It's not just that well-intentioned, hardworking people are coming to your doorstep to warn you, you know, kind of, you know, there's a cycle of giving and give back. It's not getting this kind of information, someone has to pay for it, and if it's not happening through government, then those of us who are able to really have to support it. And one way to do that is supporting organizations that are undertaking research and supporting scientists, and as well as doing public outreach like silentspring.org. So I really want to urge that. And it's also something to think about, you know, in everything. I mean, people, PBS is constantly doing fundraising drives, and I'm not interrupting our programming, but every week we can think about doing a little bit more. And you can also help by signing up at my website, healthjournalistblog.com, to be part of the group that are taking action to really protect our health through finding out about a lot of information like this and through listening every week to Connect the Dots radio on every Wednesday at 10 a.m. This is our new time on the Progressive Radio Network. So I just want to thank you so much, Robin. You're just a wealth of information. Thank you so much for the science that you're doing and for being with us and explaining so well to our listeners the importance of this information, you know, when we were all going to go out and change our shower curtains. thank you so much, and thanks to Silent Spring Institute for your work.
Well, thank you for having us and letting us talk about our work.
Okay, we'll have you back again, too. I have a feeling there's a lot more coming from, you know, from the great work you're doing. And I just want to say to listeners, you know, bookmark Connect the Dots. You can listen to our past show and archives, our past programs. We've had wonderful people, Helen Caldicott, Harvey Wasserman, Jody Evans, you know, just a whole range of really Susan Griffin, terrific guests, and more upcoming. In coming weeks, we're going to have the author of a new book about Buckminster Fuller, all about his outlook, his life. That's going to be a really terrific and fun show. We're going to have someone talking about post-traumatic stress disorder and how they have conquered their own and work with that. We're also going to be featuring some presenters from the upcoming Green Festival as it comes to New York on April 22nd, and I'm going to be presenting in two panels as well on that, so mark that in your calendars. Further ahead in May, we're going to be covering food, healthy food, how to keep organic food organic, as well as keeping fracking chemicals out of the food supply. That'll be upcoming shows. So please stay tuned every week to Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and for more information, and I'll be delighted to be there with you for some of these great conversations. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Have a great week till we meet again. Mm-hmm.